Exa was Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Steve Norman reporting. Turkey says it will continue to target U.S. allied Kurdish fighters on the Syrian frontier near its borders, despite mounting international pressure on the Ankara government to stop the artillery bombardments. Middle East scholar Peter Bechtold tells VOA this could be a problem for the U.S., which has good relations with Turkey for the most part and also is backing the Kurdish fighters in Syria who are fighting the Islamic State militants.
Not just rhetorically, but militarily, as far as we know, and for all I know, logistically as well. And the United States has apparently persuaded the government of Saudi Arabia to deploy some of its fighter aircraft to Incirlik Air Force Base, which has been a major NATO resource for several decades, and that's inside Turkey, to persuade them to have some skin in the game.
Turkish Foreign Minister Melvin Cavusoglu says no decision has yet been made on ground forces against the Islamic State, which some analysts say could dangerously widen the multifaceted conflict. Authorities in the Democratic Republic of Congo briefly detained prominent opposition figure Martin Fayulu Sunday, 2 days before a call to general strike designed to pressure President Joseph Kabila to step down from office. Mr. Kabila is legally required to step down in December from 15 years in power. Fayulu, president of the Engagement for Citizenship and Development Party, was held briefly for incitement to public disorder. Citizens are being asked to stay home Tuesday to demand elections to be held within the constitutional deadline. This is VOA News. Vote counting has begun in the Central African Republic in the presidential runoff there between two former prime ministers who pledged to bring peace and security to the nation that's seen more than 2 years of conflict. The winners will be replacing a transitional government put in place in 2014, a year after the Salika rebels pushed President Francois Bozizé from office. United Nations saying that Afghan hostilities left more than 3,500 civilians dead, nearly 7,500 others wounded in 2015. That was an increase of 4% in civilian casualties from the previous year. The report also documented a 37% increase in women casualties and a 14% increase in children killed. President Obama will seek to pull together America's leadership role in the Asia-Pacific region when he hosts all 10 Association of Southeast Asian Nations in the U.S. state of California this week. Leaders will tackle a range of critical and sensitive issues central to the strategic U.S. rebalance to the Asia-Pacific. ASEAN nations are experiencing explosive growth right now, as well as rising tensions, and that's why Mr. Obama will urge leaders to adopt a set of rules and principles that will ensure each country can pursue its own interest legally and peacefully. Daniel Russell is the Assistant U.S. Secretary of State, that is, for East Asian and Pacific Affairs.
And a cohesive ASEAN helps secure stability and growth that's built around a common commitment to rules and to fairness. It allows major countries like the United States, other powers, to engage constructively as partners. It prevents Southeast Asia from becoming a sphere of influence or becoming a battlefield.
Obama administration describes the region as the heart of the Asia Pacific and ASEAN as a good forum in which to build an infrastructure to handle a range of issues. Pope Francis continues his visit to Mexico City, where Sunday afternoon he visited a pediatric hospital. Children's Hospital is one of the city's largest, and it handles cases of cancer, genetic malformation, and neurological disorders. The Pope blessed the children and also thanked the staff.
A todas las personas.
The Pope gave thanks for all the people who make it their purpose, he says, to make others feel good, not just with medicine, but what he called the therapy of affection. Pope Francis will travel to the impoverished state of Chiapas next, where he is scheduled to give Mass into the indigenous communities there on Wednesday, a Mass in the city of Juarez. That's just across the border from the U.S. city of El Paso, Texas.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today's Monday, February 15th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. The people of Central African Republic voted Sunday in a presidential runoff election.
The first round of the legislative elections last month was so flawed with irregularities, the results were cancelled. The head of the African Union Election Observer Mission in CAR, Suleiman Ndene Ndiaye, said this time round the polling stations seemed to have enough ballot papers.
That's VOA correspondent Nick Long in Bangui. With two more days before Uganda's presidential election, main opposition party FDC responds to police warnings about holding night rallies. We'll also have reaction to Saturday's Uganda presidential election debate. And Burundi's opposition leader says those who accuse Rwanda of destabilizing Burundi are missing the point.
Nkurunziza wants to make this problem as an ethnic problem. But as a leader, we say no, the problem is not an ethnic problem. It is a political problem.
Jaminani is the exiled leader of the opposition Front for Democracy in Burundi, or FRUDEBO. And some experts say the African Union mission in Somalia is not protecting civilians from Al-Shabaab. Those stories, plus Mark Oldman's post in our Black History Month and African History Facts of the Day, are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Voters in the Central African Republic went to the polls on Sunday in the final round of presidential elections and a rerun of election to the National Assembly. Nick Long reports from the capital, Bangui.
Polling stations were relatively quiet, with just a trickle of people voting at several centres, but in the afternoon, VOA saw many more people arriving to vote. Georges Anissé Doleguele, one of the two candidates in the presidential runoff, spoke to reporters outside Bangui City Hall. He wished everyone a happy Valentine's Day and said that as Valentine's Day is a festival of love, he would like Central Africans to think of voting as an act of love for the country. There was a livelier atmosphere outside the Buganda High School in Bangui, where the other presidential challenger, Faustin Archange Touadéra, went to cast his ballot.
En tout cas, au vu de ce que nous avons pendant les meetings, dans nos réunions.
In view of what we've seen in the rallies and meetings during the campaign, which have often been very well attended, he says, I think our compatriots have heard the message and they'll act on it at the polling stations. There were 30 candidates in the first round of the presidential election, 20 of whom have since said they are backing Touadéra, while three say they're backing Doleguele. Many of those voters may abstain in the second round. Doleguele said it was too early to say if there would be many abstentions. Only a few voters VOA spoke to were willing to say how they'd voted. This student said he voted for Touadéra because he was paid his bursary regularly during the time Touadéra was prime minister up until 2013. And he thought Touadéra had done other good things, such as paying government workers regularly and upgrading some roads.
Je pense que c'est une personnalité qui incarne le changement.
This man said he voted for Doleguele because he embodies change, whereas if the other candidate is elected, he said, it will be more of the same. The first round of the legislative elections last month was so flawed with irregularities, the results were cancelled. The head of the African Union Election Observer Mission in CAR, Suleiman Ndene Ndiaye, said this time round the polling stations seemed to have enough ballot papers. Nick Long for VOA News, Bangui.
It's three more days before Ugandans go to the polls in the presidential election, where incumbent Yoweri Museveni, who has been in power for 30 years, is running for re-election. On Sunday, Police Chief General Kale Kayihura warned main opposition candidate Chisa Besigye of the Forum for Democratic Change, FDC, against holding political rallies at night, something that the police chief said is in violation of Electoral Commission regulations. FDC President retired General Mugisha Muntu said his party will not stop holding night rallies until President Museveni and his ruling National Resistance Movement Party respect the same Electoral Commission laws.
Basically, what the police should do is stop applying double standards. If really they have a problem with the holding of rallies tonight, I would believe that the best thing they have done is to call for a meeting of the Electoral Commission and all the candidates and then sit down and see how to resolve that issue. But not just threatening one side when we know that other candidates are also having the same difficulties. And it's not that that is deliberate. It's just that you find a very tight program and it happens that rallies spill over. beyond the time that is officially allotted. That the best thing would be to ask the Electoral Commission, meet with all the candidates, and see how to resolve that issue, because it affects all, well, at least for us, and we also know that the candidate Museveni has been getting into the same situation. So the application of double standards, I think, is the wrong thing for them to do at this point in time. More so when we are coming to the end of the campaign, 2 days. Just ending the campaign in 2 days. And of all these night rallies, the ones that when they spilled over into the night, all round, there has been no incident. So I would wonder what is making them excited.
You mentioned the campaigns are coming to an end. Final rallies, I understand your party and President Museveni or the NRM are having rallies in Kampala City.
The Kampala City and the campaign period is winding up on Tuesday. Wednesday is the free day nobody is allowed to campaign. And Thursday is the voting day.
How do you think the FDC, the party, your party, how is it doing? Having gone around to meet with the people of Uganda, how do you think your party going into the final round? How are you doing?
We built momentum all around the country. There are clear signals that we will be able to take the vote come 18th. And we are going to do the best we can to ensure that we protect the vote, because we know that there is a lot of panic in the movement, the party which is in power, and I suspect that that's why possibly there is the panic that there is, you know, throwing threats and all that, because they know that they don't have the vote. They know that in a free and fair and transparent election that they would lose this vote.
Retired General Mugisha Muntu is president of Uganda's main opposition party, Forum for Democratic Change. He was speaking with me from the capital, Kampala. Ugandans tuned in on Saturday as the nation's first ever presidential debate attended by all candidates, including President Yoweri Museveni, took place in Kampala. Many say it was a small victory for democracy. Elizabeth Pollard reports from Kampala.
In homes and bars across the country, Ugandans were fixated on their screens as the 8 political candidates running for president took part in the national debate. Those who could not watch tuned in on their cell phones, cheering and applauding as candidates addressed issues important to them. At the forefront was President Yoweri Museveni, who was running for his 5th term in office. Speculation over whether President Museveni would attend the debate was rampant throughout the capital, up until the moment he stepped onto the red carpet at the debate hall. Excitement was high as the debate got underway.
Ladies and gentlemen, we now have a full house.
Crispy Kaheru, a coordinator with the Citizens Coalition for Electoral Democracy in Uganda, attended the debates and said it shows an important shift in how citizens are encouraging political dialogue in Uganda.
Uganda is one of those countries where the culture of debate is not deeply entrenched. And seeing us making baby steps in that direction is very much encouraging. And beyond a debate of this nature, I think it lays a foundation for dialogue processes to happen post the election, which is important for this country.
This was a sentiment shared by many, including Jermaine Igesa, who says the organization of the event and questions posed gave him a feeling of empowerment.
I must say it makes sense discussing foreign policy with the incumbent who has been largely in charge of the foreign policy. It made a lot of sense for me. On the overall, I think it's a telling statement for people who do not believe Africa can actually practice democracy. I mean, I have been to foreign countries. I know how some stereotypes are about African politics, but I think it's a telling statement. There were no fist fights. There was no name calling. It was very civil. It's been very decent. Everybody has put their best foot forward.
Supporters of President Museveni, such as Susan Ojira, said she was glad Museveni could attend the debates this time and that she preferred his straightforward style to answering questions.
The other time when he was so busy, they started speculating that he's fearing the debate. Why should he fear debate? We feel honored. We shall feel excited because we are sure of his answers. According to the last debate, actually, it was just some candidates were failing to answer straight questions. Some were dodging questions.
Although many citizens have already picked their preferred candidate, some say the debates help them choose who to vote for. Voting in Uganda is scheduled to take place this Thursday. Elizabeth Pola for VOA News, Kampala, Uganda.
Today's Monday, February 15th, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington, and still to come, Mark Ullman Sports and our Black History Month and African History Facts of the Day. Daybreak Africa time, 15 minutes past the hour. The exiled leader of the opposition Front for Democracy in Burundi, Nuas Fredebo, says the allegation that Rwanda is involved in destabilizing Burundi is a pretext to turn the political crisis in the country into a Hutu versus Tutsi problem. Jean Minani said blaming Rwanda is a strategy by Burundian President Pierre Nkurunziza to deflect Burundi's problems to other countries.
It is the new pretext of Burundian government who don't want to go into talks. And now he found a new pretext to say, I can't go in a negotiation because if I go in the negotiation, I have nothing to do there. They have no answers for our problems. We have other refugees in Tanzania, in Congo, in Uganda. Why only the refugee of Rwanda will take guns to fight Burundi government? The problem is not between Rwanda and Burundi. The problem is between Burundians only. This government of Nkurunziza have to take his responsibility. So it is the responsibility of UN to say if the refugee take guns or not. Refugees are victims of the irresponsibility of Mr. Nkurunziza.
You are leader of Fredebu, which we understand is a Hutu progressive political party, and the government in Rwanda is Tutsi. Do you think the international community is trying to make this into an ethnic issue?
Yes. Those who talk that Rwanda helped refugees to go to fight Nkurunziza, like Nkurunziza, want to say that the problem is between Rwanda and Burundi. Nkurunziza wants to make this problem as an ethnic problem. But as a leader, we say no, the problem is not an ethnic problem. It is a political problem. It is a problem between one person, Khaled Nkurunziza, who wants to stay in the power without any legality, without any legitimacy. And all the person who think that it is a problem between Hutu and the Tutsi is a person who don't know our problem.
Dr. Minani, what do you make of the Rwandan foreign minister suggesting that if people are accusing her government, then Rwanda might consider to relocate Burundian refugees in Rwanda?
Refugees are refugees. To be refugee is not a simple problem, is a big problem. To make a new repression for a refugee, it is like to kill him twice. So if they take this solution, I say to them that it's the very bad solution that every responsible can take.
Jean Minani is the exiled leader of the opposition Front for Democracy in Burundi, known as Fredebu. He was speaking with me from the Rwandan capital, Kigali. Some Somali experts say the African Union mission in Somalia is failing to protect civilians from al-Shabaab. Sunil Suri, author of a recent report on Somalia by the London-based NGO Safer World, says the withdrawal of AMISOM troops from towns is endangering the lives of civilians as well as officials who work with the AU mission and the Somali government.
Firstly, very loudly and clearly from the people we interviewed, al-Shabaab remains undefeated, and it won't be defeated by a militarized approach led by AMISOM and the Somali National Army.
And why do you think the military approach seemed to be not working? Why is that?
Because the underlying question of a military approach is meant to provide security, but then security for who? And oftentimes, and I think it comes through the research, is that we found that security has been achieved for international actors. So we may be safe in London, we may be safe in Washington, but actually what does security mean, the Somali people mean? So the militarized approach hasn't worked because it's not been sustainable and it's not been effective in terms of ensuring that the Somali people's security needs are met. it often prioritizes international security priorities more so.
What are the recommendations of the report?
Firstly, that there's a pressing need to consider how to reduce dependency on Ethiopian and Kenyan forces as part of AMISOM. The longer they remain in Somalia, the negative behaviors I've discussed will continue and likely worsen. They'll provide opportunities for al-Shabaab and other armed actors to challenge the legitimacy of the federal government again. This could include the replacement of their forces by other African nations from further afield. In the longer term, this has to focus on reinforcing and building the Somali National Army. That's one recommendation. Two, where harm to civilians occurs, there needs to be accountability. So there's something called the Civilian Casualty Tracking Analysis and Response Cell, which is an important means for AMISOM to investigate and hold itself accountable. In August 2015, I'm sure you know, AMISOM-led investigation led them to admit that seven civilians had been killed in an operation with three personnel set to face a military judicial process. This mechanism is very under-resourced. International actors need to actually build this up. Another recommendation, and I think this is particularly relevant given the last few days, a greater emphasis needs to be placed on reinforcing people's security first. While AMISOM has a mission-wide protection of civilian strategy since May 2013, AMISOM should have a clear and explicit mandate from the United Nations Security Council to protect or provide immediate security to civilians in areas it takes from al-Shabaab. This can be included in the UN Security Council resolution authorizing AMISOM's presence. This would be designed so, you know, when they have Marka and they move out of the town and they come back and then Somalis are killed in the meantime by al-Shabaab, this would help to prevent a situation like that emerging.
Sunni Suri is author of a recent report on Somalia by the London-based NGO Safer World. He was speaking with Haroon Maruf of VOA Somali Service. The group, known as Tiniguena, works in Guinea-Bissau to promote development while also conserving the country's unique resources and biodiversity. Isla Sarr, a project assistant with Tiniguena, tells Ricky Schreier that political infighting in Guinea-Bissau's National Assembly makes it harder to pass laws that protect the country's natural resources and environment from exploitation.
What we're trying to do is to connect different spaces that are vital to Guinea-Bissau's sovereignty in terms of and food security and also biodiversity. So we are trying to connect that to the capital. More and more people are being conscious of the monetary value of the resources. So that also can be a menace from within the community. People can start exploiting, for example, timber, because they know how much it values outside the community. And they can have the monetary income that they can invest in other things. And also, one of the threats is the tourism. When it's not done in a sustainable way, when it doesn't take into account the interests of the community, the needs of the community, when it's just exploitation tourism, you know, just comes and takes advantage of whatever is there, without, regardless of the community. And empowering the community, it's also making sure that they are aware of the benefits that tourism or other activities, economic activities, can have to that specific community. But also, they have to make sure they know the threats and the menaces that that kind of activities has. And they can make a decision that will be a conscious decision.
That was Isla Sarr, a project assistant at Tiniguena. She was speaking with Ricky Schreier from Bissau. It's time now for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Very good Monday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa Sports news, we begin with volleyball. Kenya dismissed hosts Cameroon by 3-1. Botswana edged Uganda 3-2. And Algeria beat Egypt 3-1 at the Africa Women's Volleyball Olympic qualifiers in Yaounde on Sunday. On Saturday, Algeria dismissed Uganda in 3 straight sets. Egypt beat Botswana 3-0 and Kenya dismissed Tunisia 3-0. Earlier on Friday, Egypt beat Uganda 3-0. Cameroon pipped Tunisia 3-2 and Algeria outplayed Botswana 3-0. Today, Monday, Kenya play Egypt as Algeria Nigeria encounter Cameroon in the semifinals, while Botswana play Tunisia in a classification tie. Turning to athletics, Kenya's Florence Kiplagat clocked 1 hour 9 minutes and 19 seconds to win the Barcelona half marathon in Spain for the third consecutive year on Sunday. Vincent Kipruto won the men's race in 1 hour 2 minutes and 54 seconds. Meanwhile, in a sprint for the finish line, world cross-country champion Geoffrey Kamworor outpaced defending champion Bedan Karoki and the Africa cross-country champion Leonard Barsoton to lead a 1-2-3 Kenyan triumph in the men's 10 kilometers at the IAAF cross-country permit meet in Nairobi, Kenya on Saturday. In contrast, Kenya's All-Africa Games 10,000-meter champion Alice Aprot blew away the field to win the senior women's 10-kilometer race. Kenya's World Youth 2,000-meter steeplechase silver medalists Nixon Kiplagat and Sandra Felis Chebet won the junior men's 8 kilometers and junior women's 6 kilometers, respectively. In Belgium, Morocco's Mustafa Smaili clocked 1 minute and 46.50 seconds to win the men's 800 meters at the IFAM indoor meet in Ghent on Saturday. Ethiopian Dawit Wold prevailed in 1500 meters as Kenya's Boniface Mweresa was second in 400 meters and the Central African Republic's Berange Bossi third in 60 meters. Meanwhile, Morocco's Malika Akawi and Ethiopian Habtam Alemu prevailed in the women's 1500 meters and 800 meters, respectively. In cricket, Afghanistan beat Zimbabwe by 5 wickets in the finals of the plate category at the ICC Under-19 Cricket World Cup in Cox Bazar in Bangladesh on Friday, while South Africa beat New Zealand by 138 runs in the 11th place playoff. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good day.
Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right.
It's time now for our Black History Month and African History Facts and Trivia question for today, February 15th. On this day in 1968, Henry Louis became the first African-American to lead a symphony orchestra in the United States, the New Jersey Symphony Orchestra. He began studying piano at the age of 5 and later learned to play the clarinet, as well as several string instruments. Also on this day in 1804, the New Jersey legislature approved a law calling for gradual emancipation for African-Americans. By doing so, New Jersey became the last northern state in the U.S. to outlaw slavery. And during this Black History Month, we want to tell you about Thurgood Marshall, the first African-American Supreme Court Justice. Before that, he was legal director of the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, the NAACP. Thurgood Marshall won a famous case, Brown versus the Board of Education, which desegregated public schools in the United States. Marshall died on January 24, 1993, at the age of 84. Today, the U.S. Supreme Court has one Black Associate Justice, Clarence Thomas. Did you know that John Brown was a radical white abolitionist who is famous for his participation in an anti-slavery warfare in the United States for his 1859 raid on the federal armory in Harper's Ferry, Virginia? Brown hoped that the attack on the armory would rouse the local slaves to rise up and claim their freedom. But his plan did not completely materialize, and Brown was captured, tried in Charleston, Virginia, and sentenced to be hanged for inciting slave rebellion. Those are your Black History Month and African History Facts for today, February 15th. Congratulations to Maurice Umiakuka of the Federal Polytechnic in Oko, Nigeria, and Inquin Rabos Akia of Mbinga Baptist Hospital in Bamenda, Cameroon. You are the winners of our February 12th question, which Virginia slave packaged himself to freedom in a wooden box? The answer, Henry Brown. Now here is our question for today, February 15th. Who wrote the lyrics for Lift Every Voice and Sing, which is sometimes called the Negro or Black National Anthem? Once again, who wrote the lyrics for Lift Every Voice and Sing, sometimes called the Negro or Black National Anthem? Send your answers to Daybreak Africa at voanews.com. Remember to include your mailing address.
Get up, stand up.
And that's it for this Monday, February 15th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for joining us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I'm James Butte in Washington saying, have a lovely day, Africa.
Next time on Straight Talk Africa.
We'll discuss the Uganda presidential elections with Shaka Sali in Uganda and me, Esther Gidu Yuart, as the studio guest host. Tune in to Straight Talk Africa next Wednesday at 18:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.